Today at Reader's Corner, Jim Ratzenberger, author of The Brilliant Disaster, JFK, Castro, and America's Doomed Invasion of Cuba's Bay of Pigs.
It's really about how brilliance can be a double-edged sword. As somebody said about John Kennedy afterwards, he was a man who'd never failed at anything, which is one reason why when this went so badly, Kennedy was devastated. People on both sides of the aisle, liberals and conservatives alike, were very concerned about the spread of communism. And to look soft on communism was to seem somehow unmanned. Kennedy was looking for some victory to score against the communists. If you look at it, really, the road to the jungles of Vietnam began on the beaches of the Bay of Pigs.
I'm Bob Custra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. On an April night in 1961, a U.S.-backed invasion of Cuba was launched by CIA-trained Cuban exiles. The plan was to start an uprising that would result in the overthrow of communist leader Fidel Castro. Now infamous, the Bay of Pigs was marred by miscalculations and setbacks and ended up being arguably the biggest military blunder in American history. The failed operation was an embarrassment to President John F. Kennedy only 3 months into his term of office, as well as the CIA. The Cuban exiles were left without air support after launching the attack, and many were captured and imprisoned. Overall, 114 of the 1,400 troops on the American side perished. Castro's reign continued, outlasting the administrations of 10 U.S. presidents. In The Brilliant Disaster, JFK, Castro, and America's Doomed Invasion of Cuba's Bay of Pigs, journalist and author Jim Ratzenberger uses recently declassified CIA information to bring a new perspective to the failed operation. Today we're featuring an encore edition of our interview with Mr. Ratzenberger. He joins us by phone from New York City. Jim Ratzenberger, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
The basics of this plan, the part of the plan that seems the most outrageous to me, and maybe you can help us understand how they were going to pull this off, was not getting to the shore, not the training in Guatemala, but the part of the plan that was to stir up the insurrection among the people. And I'm not even so sure I completely understand how that was to be pulled off. Once these 1,400 troops, let's say it was successful, and they get to the shore and nobody spots them and they take off for the hinterlands, now what are they going to do?
Well, the idea really was to get a beachhead and then hold the beachhead for a significant period of time, say a week up to 10 days. And the CIA had been putting together a council, a revolutionary council that was in Miami. And these guys could then be flown in as a provisional government. They'd land them on this beachhead. And this provisional government would then declare themselves the rightful leaders of a free Cuba. And then, yes, as you mentioned, then it was hoped that perhaps this would stir the pot within Cuba and embolden those people who were anti-Castro to rise up against Castro. But another thing the provisional government could do was, in a sort of quasi-legal way, invite assistance from the United States, overt military assistance. See, it was sort of a foot in Cuba, a crack in the door, if you will, to allow the United States to get involved. This is the way the CIA plan originally looked at it. Now, the question of uprisings within Cuba is an interesting one because Kennedy always thought that the CIA had promised that these would occur. The CIA really didn't have that much evidence that they would occur because, you know, most of the anti-Castro Cubans by this point were either in Cuban jails or they'd fled Cuba and they were in Miami or Mexico City or somewhere else. So there weren't that many anti-Cubans left in Cuba when this happened. But nonetheless, the CIA hoped that if they could hold on to this beachhead, it would change the tone in Cuba. It would allow those people who had sort of, you know, secret anti-Castro feelings that they were afraid to show to feel that they could help out. And by the way, there were American ships right offshore that had all sorts of arms, including 30,000 rifles, to give to Cubans who decided that they wanted to join this rebellion against Castro.
Did any part of the plan actually include taking out Castro personally? Like, was there some way they were going to get to him to remove him, to put it politely?
assassination was always, I wouldn't say it was part of the Bay of Pigs plan. It was a sort of parallel plan. And Richard Bissell, the director of plans for the CIA who really ran this operation, always hoped that this could either happen coincidentally, coinciding with the invasion itself, or as an entirely different plot. And there are just so many bizarre stories about the CIA's attempts to kill Castro, but one of the most serious ones, if that's the right word for it, was to hire the mafia to basically do a hit on Castro. And not just Castro, perhaps, but also Che Guevara and Raul Castro, to sort of take all three of them out at the same time. There was a poison that the CIA labs concocted that could be given to Castro, be put into his food, that would kill him. Over the years, this is both before the Bay of Pigs and even after the Bay of Pigs, there were at least 8 plots to try to assassinate Fidel Castro.
Well, when I read that section of your book, I thought of Jimmy Breslin's novel, The Gang That Couldn't Shoot Straight, which is just really just a fun novel about how the wicked mob goofs up and doesn't exactly get things right. And, of course, over and over again, that seemed to be the case here. I'd like for you to at least relate to our listeners the section where the CIA is working with Sam Giancana, and Sam has another problem unrelated to the Bay of Pigs, and this is a little bit of a footnote to your book, I guess, but it's just so doggone outrageous and funny in a strange sort of a way, regarding Phyllis McGuire, the then very popular singer who was hanging out with mobsters and Hollywood types. As I understand it, the CIA was actually called in to help Sam.
Yes. Well, Sam was concerned that his girlfriend was having an affair, and he got help from the CIA to spy on his girlfriend and to find out what was going on. And it was just one of the many bizarre sort of subplots of this whole thing. I mean, the CIA came to discover that you can't really count on the mob as a reliable partner. And, you know, it's one of the odd things about this is, I mentioned Richard Bissell, the director of plans. He was this Connecticut blue blood. He'd gone to Groton boarding school. He'd gone to Yale. And the idea of him mixing up with the mafia was just hilarious. And, in fact, you know, he would get phone calls from people in the mafia. They'd try to call him at his office, you know, their new best friend in the CIA, and he would always tell his secretary, "I'm not here. Don't take the phone calls." But, you know, Bissell's attitude was, if we have to rub our hands in this dirty business, well, maybe something will come of it. In the end, he thought the ends justified the means, even if the means seemed to be, on the surface, rather ridiculous.
Well, let's talk about this aspect of Richard Bissell's background for a moment. A couple of weeks ago, Russ Douthat, who writes for the New York Times, wrote an article called "Our Reckless Meritocracy," and he was actually talking about John Corzine bringing down MF Global by mislaying about $600 million of customer money. But there was one paragraph in there, when I was reading it, I was in the middle of your book, and I thought, wow, I have to read this to Jim and just have him comment on the nature of the decision-making process, that is, who they were. And Douthat says, "In meritocracies, though, it's the very intelligence of our leaders that creates the worst disasters. Convinced that their own skills are equal to any task or challenge, meritocrats take risks that lower wattage elites would never seem to contemplate, embark on more hubristic projects, or become infatuated with statistical models that hold out the promise of a perfectly rational and frictionless world." And then Calvin Trillin, I guess, is quoted as here in saying, in regard to the Wall Street shenanigans, "Do you think our guys could have invented, say, credit default swaps? Give me a break. They couldn't have done the math." So you're dealing with a group of people here who these are the best and the brightest.
Right. I mean, I missed that column, so I'm glad you read that to me, because that really is one of the themes of my book. You know, the brilliant in the title of my book, The Brilliant Disaster, refers to that, and it's really about how brilliance can be a double-edged sword. When these guys all got in a room, Richard Bissell, McGeorge Bundy, he was the National Security Advisor, another guy who went to Groton and Yale and had never failed at anything in his life. He'd been the dean at Harvard when he was 34 years old. You had Robert McNamara, who'd been the president of Ford when he was 40 years old. You had the Secretary of State, Dean Rusk, a Rhodes Scholar. In fact, there were a huge number of Rhodes Scholars in the Kennedy administration. All these guys were brilliant, and they were used to succeeding. And as I joke sometimes, maybe one of the lessons of this is presidents should make sure they have a few not very brilliant people in their administration, sort of regular guys, I don't know, like me, I'm available, who could say, well, wait a minute, maybe this won't work. You know, the problem with people who are really bright and really successful at everything they do is that they're not well enough acquainted with Murphy's Law, which is that things sometimes don't work out that well. Things go wrong sometimes. As somebody said about John Kennedy afterwards, he was a man who'd never failed at anything, which is one reason why when this went so badly, Kennedy was devastated. He was just incredibly depressed, wanted to quit being president, walked around with his head down for weeks on afterwards, thought basically that his presidency was over.
You know, when I was a graduate student studying American foreign policy in a seminar, the professor required us to read a book that I've referred to so many times in my career called Groupthink by Irving Janis. And you mention that book and how it applies to this, which is really the next step of all these bright guys getting together in one room. Now they're trying to make a decision. Help us understand what happens when groupthink takes over.
Yeah, I mean, groupthink was inspired by the Bay of Pigs. He has other scenarios in it, but that was really the reason that he wrote that book. And he was really referring in that book to this one very particular meeting that occurred on April 4th, just over a week before the invasion began, when all the guys running this operation met at the State Department for the final decision. And everyone in that room later said that they had serious concerns about the invasion, but nobody voiced them when they were in that room. And they basically, because it was, I think it's concurrence thinking, I think is the term that Janis uses, that there is an incentive in a group like that to try to reach some sort of agreement. And remember, they were early in the administration. All these guys were new to their job. Nobody wanted to stand out as the guy raising his hand saying, no, this is a bad idea. If you add to that the fact that, as I said, a lot of them had very similar backgrounds in the Kennedy administration. That prep school, Ivy League education was common among a lot of them. So they were coming out of the same school of thought. They'd look at each other and they could sort of see themselves, guys who had similar resumes. And nobody really dared to stand up against the crowd, except at that meeting. Interestingly, there was one outsider at that meeting. It was Senator William Fulbright. This is the man after whom the Fulbright Scholarship is named, senator from Arkansas. Fulbright had caught wind of the plan, and he wrote a memo to Kennedy. And in fact, Kennedy invited him on his flight to Florida for the Easter break just before this meeting. And Fulbright tried to convince Kennedy that this was a terrible idea. Well, Fulbright accompanies Kennedy on the way back to Washington on Air Force One. And Kennedy says to him, how about coming to this meeting with me? So Fulbright says, sure, I'll come. And he goes into this meeting, and he's the one guy in this meeting who stands up and says, this is a terrible idea. Well, he played the role that Janis writes about, which is the role of the foil. When you have one person who sort of stands up and speaks out against what everyone else is for, he becomes the scapegoat. And in fact, what he did is he even escalated some of the anger in that room. People focused their anger against Fulbright, saying, how dare you stand up against us at this point? The planning has gone too far. And it sort of sealed the convictions that some people had that they had to be for the operation.
You're listening to Jim Rassenberger. He is the author of The Brilliant Disaster, JFK, Castro, and America's Doomed Invasion of Cuba's Bay of Pigs. If we could just stay on this subject for a moment, Jim, to explore the opponents to this plan. As I remember it, and I'm missing one or two, but certainly Arthur Schlesinger Jr., Adlai Stevenson were two of the main opponents of this. They're looked upon, and I think you say this in the book at some point, you know, Stevenson was considered kind of an egghead.
Right.
Schlesinger's an academic. And then even Fulbright. I mean, Fulbright, he was viewed in the Senate as a guy who was a little out of step, ended up being, you know, a major opponent of the war. I guess it goes back to they needed somebody in the room who maybe had a blue collar on or something. But Your thoughts?
Yeah, and I think it also has a lot to do with the climate at the time, particularly regarding anti-communism. People on both sides of the aisle, liberals and conservatives alike, were very concerned about the spread of communism. And to look soft on communism was to be even worse than an egghead. It was to seem somehow unmanned. And John Kennedy really won the presidency, at least this was Richard Nixon's point of view, by beating the Eisenhower administration over the head with Fidel Castro. How dare they allow this communist dictator to come into power on an island 90 miles from American shores? So when he comes into power, he comes in with an anti-communist agenda, and particularly an anti-Castro agenda. And for anyone in the administration to stand up and say, you know, maybe this is not a good idea to send military force in to try to unseat Castro, was almost to make himself look weak. And Ted Sorensen, Kennedy's speechwriter, later wrote about this in his book, that there was a real fear of doing that. And again, remember that this is very early in the administration, so everybody's new to their office. Nobody wants to be the guy who looks weak.
Well, boy, when it comes to Kennedy, there is no question that he boxed himself into some kind of a corner. I mean, in the campaign, help us understand how he did this. First of all, in one sense, it relates to a specific briefing he had by Dulles, and I guess the question is still out there whether he used some national security briefing in a campaign mode when he should have kept it to himself.
Yeah, well, it's a funny story, actually. John Kennedy had been briefed right after he was nominated as a Democratic candidate by Alan Dulles in Hyannisport in the summer of 1960. Whether or not Dulles told him about the Bay of Pigs operation later became a really good question that was quite controversial, because you remember those famous debates between Nixon and Kennedy. Just before the fourth debate, Kennedy released a statement in which he said that the Eisenhower administration really should get rid of Castro, and they ought to do it by using anti-Castro exiles to go back into Cuba and overthrow Fidel Castro, exactly what the Eisenhower administration was secretly doing. And Richard Nixon had been a big proponent of this operation, had been very involved in it. When Richard Nixon read this statement from Kennedy, he was outraged. He thought that Kennedy must have been tipped off to the operation by Dulles. Well, they go into the fourth debate, and Nixon immediately raises this issue. And rather than supporting what Kennedy has said, Nixon feels like it's his, I think he referred to it as his uncomfortable and ironic duty, to say that it's a terrible idea to use Cuban exiles to invade Cuba. Essentially, he's trying to protect the secrecy of the operation. But it was this bizarre situation where Richard Nixon is arguing for exactly the opposite of what he actually believes. Nixon later thought that the position that he took in that fourth debate and the fact that he allowed Kennedy to outflank him as an anti-communist, anti-Castro hawk is what got him beaten in the election. And by the way, this is sort of the seeds of Watergate begin here, because Nixon's lesson here was he was never going to let himself be out-tricked on tactical maneuvers ever again. And this is sort of the beginning of Nixon really making sure that no one ever got the better of him again. And from this early Cuban episode, you can trace the beginnings of Watergate, which happened just 12 years later.
Well, while we're on Nixon, let's back up a little further than that and talk about the role that Eisenhower played.
Yeah. Well, this really was an Eisenhower operation more than it was a Kennedy operation, at least at the beginning. You have to remember, Eisenhower had the operation for a year. He approved it on March 17th of 1960. Now, the operation changed quite a bit under Eisenhower, and then when it was handed off to Kennedy, Kennedy did a number of things to it that really changed it quite significantly. And right after the invasion, Kennedy, who kind of resented Eisenhower for having put this plan together and then sort of laid it on his lap, he invited Eisenhower to Camp David. This was on April 22nd, just 3 days after the invasion failed. And he was clearly looking for a little bit of consolation from Eisenhower, looking, for a sort of an ally in Eisenhower. But Eisenhower, when he got to Camp David, really just lit into Kennedy and said, if I had done this, I never would have allowed this to fail. When you commit American prestige it has to succeed. And, you know, this was a very painful event for Kennedy. And the question is what Eisenhower would have done if he'd actually launched the invasion himself. Would he have put overt American force into it to make sure it did succeed, as many people thought Kennedy should have done? And I don't really know the answer to that. You know, Eisenhower and Kennedy both were very concerned about starting some sort of terrible incident with the Soviet Union that might lead to nuclear war, which is why Kennedy was very reluctant, once the invasion was clearly starting to go bad, reluctant to send in American jets, as many people asked him to do, because he thought that the Soviets would respond in kind, probably in West Berlin, and then there would be this series of escalating events that could lead to war.
But you do point out that, after all, Eisenhower was the mastermind behind the D-Day invasion, so he knew at least how to pull off an invasion. Kennedy was on a PT-109 and a lieutenant who didn't really have any experience with invasion. So one could draw the conclusion that if Eisenhower had followed this through, it would have been done a little differently than Kennedy.
Absolutely. There's certainly, you know, one thing I think Eisenhower would have done is made sure that the administrative business was handled better. I mean, when Kennedy first came into office, there was just something sort of shoddy about how things were run. So a lot of the information flow didn't go very well. Kennedy didn't know a lot of basic facts about it. Kennedy was making fairly critical decisions without consulting with people he should have consulted with. But, you know, I don't think you can say just because Eisenhower led D-Day that he would have had a stronger presence, American presence, in this invasion. Because, remember, D-Day was pre-nukes. And once you had nuclear weapons, how you defeated the enemy became completely different. You couldn't just, you know, of course, the United States could have gotten rid of Castro if they wanted to. They could have just sent in the Marines. But the reason they made it a covert operation and tried to hide the American hand was to prevent provoking the Soviet Union, to stay out of some sort of escalating crisis that would lead to nuclear war. So many people have said to me, Eisenhower would, you know, he would have sent in American forces to end this thing. And maybe he would have. But Eisenhower, just like Kennedy, was very concerned about sparking something that he couldn't control. And he would have known, just like Kennedy, that the moment you commit overt American force, this becomes an American operation. And as soon as it becomes an overt American operation, then you have to win it. And then you have to be prepared for the consequences of what will follow afterwards.
You mentioned JFK's last-minute decision to cancel the follow-up airstrikes to support the invaders. How did the lack of air cover impact the troops being deployed at the Bay of Pigs?
It was everything. What happened is there were two series of airstrikes that were planned in advance of the invasion. Well, the first one was for April 15th, 2 days before the invasion. And the reason for these airstrikes was to take out Fidel's small air force. He had about 18 airplanes. Well, this April 15th airstrike took out just over half of them, leaving Castro with six or seven planes. On the morning of April 17th, as the invasion was landing in Cuba, there was supposed to be another airstrike to take out the rest of Castro's air force. But the previous evening, April 16th, John Kennedy canceled this airstrike. Now, I mentioned that he didn't consult with people he should have consulted with. Kennedy made this decision more or less on his own after talking to Dean Rusk, his Secretary of State. Well, this was a devastating blow because those airplanes that Castro still had, the moment that the invasion landed, those planes took off. Castro told them, ignore the brigade. Don't worry about the men on the beach. Sink the ships. So they went after the ships. They immediately sank two out of six supply ships. The other four took off with Horizon, leaving the brigade without any medicine, without any ammunition, without any food, and basically without any chance of succeeding. They were just marooned there on the beaches, being bombarded by Castro's planes, being bombarded by his artillery. And the moment that second airstrike was canceled, basically the whole thing was over, and everybody in the CIA knew it. Now, what they tried to do to prevent the catastrophe from unfolding was to get Kennedy to then send in some American jets, because there was a United States aircraft carrier, the Essex, just over the horizon, and it had A-4 Skyhawks on it. And if Kennedy had unleashed a few of these, he could have taken down Castro's planes, and he could have turned this whole thing around. Kennedy struggled with this thing mightily, a lot of pressure to do it. And the reason, you know, to this day, the Cuban exiles who participated in this hate Kennedy is because he canceled those airstrikes, and then he refused to help out when they were suffering on the beaches. Sort of, they believe that he just left them to be slaughtered. You know, it's when you talk to these guys now, some of the men who participated in the invasion, you can still feel their grief and their anger, as real today as it was 50 years ago.
How did the experience of the Bay of Pigs change Kennedy's administration, his relationship to advisors?
Well, that's a great question. The conventional wisdom is that it really prepared him for the Cuban Missile Crisis, which came 18 months later, because Kennedy realized that he had to rely less on the CIA, less on the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and more on advisors he really trusted, particularly his brother Robert. And I think that conventional wisdom is true, and Kennedy clearly was a much better leader by the time the Cuban Missile Crisis came around, and it probably saved us from nuclear catastrophe during the Cuban Missile Crisis. But there's some other interesting things that happened. I'm sure you know the famous Situation Room, where all major decisions are made now. That began with the Bay of Pigs, because George Bundy and Kennedy realized that there had been administrative failures, and Bundy particularly wanted to have some sort of central command where the White House could get real-time information and make decisions on its own, not rely on second-hand information from either the Defense Department or from the CIA. But there were longer-term consequences that played out in American history. For example, on April 20th, of 1961, the day after the invasion failed, Kennedy did three things that had a huge impact on the future of the United States. One of them was largely symbolic. He appointed his vice president, Lyndon Johnson, to look into the space program. He wanted to defeat the Soviets in outer space, and this is what led eventually to the moon landing in 1969. He also appointed a task force in the Pentagon to look for further ways to get rid of Fidel Castro. Rather than back down from the confrontation with Castro, he stepped it up. And in fact, this became an obsession for him and his brother Robert for almost the entire remainder of the administration. And the last thing he did was appoint a task force on that day to look into ways to prevent communist domination of South Vietnam. Until this moment, South Vietnam had really been a back burner issue for the American government. But Kennedy was looking for some victory to score against the communists, and his advisors said, you know, Vietnam might be the place to go. So he appointed this task force. 7 days later, the task force came back advising that we increase the number of our advisors in Vietnam. And, you know, if you look at it, really, the road to the jungles of Vietnam began on the beaches of the Bay of Pigs.
Well, Jim, we've run out of time, but I must say that my staff and I commented after reading the book that it's like reading a novel. I mean, you've done such a great job of telling a story, obviously based on relatively new information that's been released by the CIA. It may be called The Brilliant Disaster, but you've done a brilliant job writing it. Jim Rassenberger, thank you so much for joining us today on Reader's Corner.
Thank you for having me.
I hope you enjoyed this encore edition of our interview with Jim Rassenberger. Next week, baseball legend Jim Abbott, author of Imperfect and Improbable Life. Born without a right hand, Abbott was the pitcher for the gold medal Olympic team in 1988 and went on to pitch for 10 seasons on 4 different big league teams before retiring in 1999. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, research and production by Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.